Hey guys, just to give you a quick trigger warning, the next two episodes contain topics of capture and torture of a character. So if this is something you're sensitive about, you may want to give the next 2 weeks a skip. If you or someone you know has been a victim of a human rights violation and is looking for help, Amnesty International has a 24-hour hotline of specially trained individuals to get you to the right place. Call 1-800-AMNESTY, that's 1-800-266-3789, or visit amnesty.org. Hey everybody, it's Andrea. Today, it's Good Dad, Bad Dad in Space. Michael Scott would love how much no time they have. And we ask the question, do you think Jellicoe is a punchable face yet or not? Stay tuned.
Welcome to the TNG Podcast, the number one place in the Alpha Quadrant to geek out about all things Star Trek The Next Generation. I'm your co-host, Charisse.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Andrea. Charisse, today we're talking Season 6, Episode 10, Chain of Command, Part 1. This episode was written by Frank Abbate-Marco and directed by Robert Shearer. Captain Picard is relieved of command of the Enterprise and reassigned to lead a covert mission, while his replacement is assigned to deal with Cardassians openly. Oh, God.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yes. I mean, Captain Picard being relieved is like, wait, what? It's like record scratch, right?
Yes. Yes. It's definitely a clutch your pearls kind of moment.
Yeah.
Before we get started and jump into our initial thoughts, we have a special guest with us, David White, who actually has been here before in the show. Andrea, remind us, where can people find David's previous episode?
David was with us for season 3, episode 15, Yesterday's Enterprise, which is like one of the best ones of the whole series, like such a fan favorite. So if you are new to the podcast and you're loving David as much as we do, go back and listen to season 3, episode 15, because you'll hear more of him there.
Yes. And even if you don't love David, go back and listen anyways, because that was just a good episode.
It's just an amazing episode.
Anyway, so to let you know a little bit about David, for those who are newly being introduced to this wonderful person, David L. White is a voice artist, a video and podcast producer, and more recently, a podcast host. He has a show called Permission to Win. He's actually a co-host on that, I believe, right? And he lives near Nashville, Tennessee. He's been an avid Star Trek fan since watching the original series in syndication as a kid. When TNG launched, it launched right before he graduated high school. And so, of course, he was a fan then. But since the streaming services have now become more popular, he's seen every single Star Trek series multiple times. Now, let me ask you, David, have you seen Prodigy?
I have watched a few episodes of Prodigy.
Okay, we'll count it then. I was going to say, if you haven't seen it, you can't make that claim that you've seen all the show. Okay, you've seen
I need episodes. I need to go back and watch some more, because one of our guest stars this episode is also in there. I think they bring back his character.
Captain Jellicoe?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So.
At least that was on his IMDb as a...
As a credit.
As a credit, yeah. Mm,
that's interesting. That is super interesting. I've watched a few episodes of Prodigy. And then I stopped. Well, anywho, David, hello and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for letting me come back and enjoy this very monumental episode.
Yeah, totes. What are your initial thoughts?
Well, let me just say, I was kind of surprised that this wasn't going to be a skip, because these are heavy. These are heavy. And, I know that it's very triggering, some of it.
Yep.
Just general behavior and throughout some of it is triggering. So those are my initial thoughts. This is heavy. This one's not a lot of fun in these episodes.
I'm going to go ahead and say zero fun whatsoever.
Yep.
What my initial thoughts were was that I was actually excited to review these two episodes because they are so memorable to me. Like, they really maybe sear my brain, like scar my brain, but they're very, very memorable. And as it often happens, the second episode is better than the first. So really, the second episode is the one I remember more than the first. I don't totally remember what happened. I didn't totally remember what happened in this one other than like the commando training. Mm-hmm. But even though it's really heavy, I remember thinking that Sir Patrick Stewart's acting while being tortured was really impressive. Again, that's in episode 2. So I'm looking forward to breaking this down with you guys. And I agree. It is. It's very heavy. It's very traumatizing. It's very triggering. There's zero fun. Even though this is not a skip for me, it's definitely not a rewatch for me. It's not, yeah. It's not making those top 10, top 20 lists. What about you, Andrea?
I mean, I feel the same way. I remember watching these for the first time and being like, what the hell? Like, it's so triggering, which is why I've popped that trigger warning at the top of the episode. I do remember that this episode in particular has all that like intense training and the ultra cool, like on all black ensembles that Worf and Beverly and Picard wear. I also remember this as the episode where Counselor Troi reaches her final form. She puts away the boobs and brings out the brain, and she's in like an official regulation uniform, and I'm here for it. Like, I understand scores and scores of young men and women were like devastated when the boobs went away, but
they have
like,
so many seasons to fall back on to check
they
them out
do.
Again.
They do. I mean, we're almost halfway through season six, which is the penultimate season, which I get really sad about. But yeah, I mean, if that's what you're there for, then there's tons and tons of like backlog on that. But I really love that like going forward, she has more of a command, more of a presence, more of a professional. She doesn't lose her softness, you know, but she's just less of like bimbo cheerleader, which like I really hate seeing women written in those roles. So yeah, those are sort of my initial thoughts on this. By the way, as a little point of trivia, these two episodes, Chain of Command Part 1 and then next week's Part 2, were the last TNG episodes to air before DS9 started airing. So yeah, these were the very last. And then going forward, they were running in parallel with each other, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting because DS9, like I haven't watched all of DS9 or I don't recall watching it. So I'm going to say I haven't. And I did a rewatch recently starting back at season one. But overall, it's like a heavier series from what I've heard. So this feeling in Chain of Command 1 and 2 feels like it fits more with DS9 than what I typically think of for TNG. I don't think of that as like a serious drama. I think of it as like a space adventure, you know, kind of fun and quirky.
Yeah. You know, and that's really interesting, too, because I've seen in some of the convention panels where the, you know, cast and crew are talking about TNG and blah, blah, blah. They, you know, Marina Sirtis did say that they started making, they being Paramount, started making DS9 and thinking that TNG fans would funnel right into DS9. But it's a completely different kind of show. Mm-hmm. It's more, I find it to be more of like a space soap opera, which isn't totally my vibe, but like I also appreciate it's more long form storytelling and stuff like that. So there's totally an audience for that. But Paramount was sadly mistaken if they thought all of TNG fans were just going to immediately jump into DS9 and just like love it. The numbers did not support that. But I do think, you know, listen, the more Star Trek, the better, in my opinion. Yep. So it's, you know, it's not a major loss. It was just like, okay, but these two are the last two before DS9 started airing. Which
I thought if I can jump in and say, you know, all things, nothing is new, I guess is the way to say that. There's nothing new under the sun. Paramount launched DS9 to launch the UPN, United Paramount Network.
Yes, they did. I remember that.
And so that's why people, partly why people couldn't find their way over there, because it wasn't, they didn't, couldn't like run them back to back because DS9 or TNG was, it was on two different networks because I think TNG was always syndicated. But yeah, so they brought those two together. And again, like you say, they had a different storyline, but it had a lot more story arcs.
Yes.
That's so interesting. We're going to call that an oopsie on Paramount's part, but you know, a good plan, a great idea. It just didn't totally work out.
It's so you live and you learn, Paramount.
Well, they didn't.
Which apparently they're still learning how to make a freaking streaming platform because like there isn't one day that goes by that there isn't some major glitch on my Paramount Plus. And I'm like, curses, like trying to watch something. Like it's just, God, they've got a long way to go. Like they just have so
10 seconds
to go.
Even. Yeah. Let's just figure out the remote, how the remote works.
Yeah. You know what I have noticed is when I watch the episodes to do the reviews, I often will pause and do my review. When I hit play, let's say I'm typing for 2 minutes. When I hit play, the story picks up 2 minutes from where I pause, where I'm like, now I got to go back. Or if I'm like, hey, what did they say? I want to write down the name of that technology. You know how, like, when you hit like back 10 seconds, it shows you the screens, like the thumbnails of the shots. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It just shows thumbnails from the very top of the episode, no matter if I'm at minute 2 or 17 or 30. I'm like, get it together, Paramount.
Seriously, I think Netflix has just spoiled us, you know, and Prime, where you can see the scenes with the little scroll thingy without actually clicking on it. So you can find the scene you're looking for, versus Paramount wants it to be a mystery. We don't know what you're going to get when you click this, when you click this time stamp. We don't know. Anyways, hopefully this will all be fixed by the time you guys are listening to this recording in the not so distant future. All right. So going into the actual episode, here we go. It starts out with Vice Admiral Nechayev, who I thought we saw before. Like, she seems familiar, but maybe I just remember her from this episode. But she comes on board. She walks into the ready room where Picard and Riker are talking. She immediately dismisses Riker from the room, and he's like, okay. And this is always a bad sign, by the way. Whenever admirals show up and dismiss Riker, that's always a bad sign because they're keeping some secrets. And that's not how Riker and Picard roll. So you're already like, uh-oh. And then she turns to Picard, who's very much like, hey, you want some tea? You want to sit down? He's all friendly. And she's just like, we don't have time for that. I'm here to relieve you of command. And then it cuts to commercial break. That was a bump, bump, bump.
Bump, bump, bump.
That's a super bump, bump, bump. And also, I've noticed this is the absolute shortest cold open in all of TNG. It's like 18 or 20 seconds long, where I did comment that, like, oh God, it was like a season or two ago where it was like the longest cold open they had was like 7.5 minutes or something. Yeah. And this one was like 20 seconds, too long. Trim it to 19. Let's go. It's like,
and that's
dang.
All we needed. Like, that was all we needed. Perfect intro. When you hear that, you're like, what? I have to come back for the commercial break. That's all we needed.
I mean, Picard, who we know, we love, we trust, with command of the ship. He's proven himself time and time again to his crew, to us as viewers. He like never fails or never puts a foot out of line. And to be like, you're relieved of duty. It's like, what? You know, it just becomes this huge question mark. David, do you remember what your initial thoughts were on that when you first saw this?
This is not one of those that I can call back and say, that was the day. I don't, you know, what I do remember about these is the guest stars and that, they pulled out some, they threw down some money to get these guest stars.
They really did. Even in next week's episode, which is part two, I did a little research on Gol Madred, who's the like torturer. Mm-hmm. And like that man is like a Royal Shakespearean actor. And also, I mean, like he's a big time, exceptionally trained actor. And it shows because he makes himself so punchable. Which is what you want from, you know, a torture. Like, that's what you want. Right? You don't want him to be personable and cool.
he's such a great torturer because he's both. He's got like this personality where you want to be his friend. He's good cop, bad cop rolled into one, which we'll get into in next week's episode.
Next week, yeah.
So, okay. Next, we find ourselves in the observation lounge and Vice Admiral Nechayev is explaining to the senior staff what's going on. And she's saying the Cardassians seem to be getting ready to come into Federation space, and this may or may not spark a war because why are they in our space? So we're going to have some negotiations, to have some talks, but we're sending the Enterprise as a symbol so they know we're serious about these talks, right? In other words, it's a subtle flex, right? It's a little bit of a like, yeah, okay, we're here to negotiate, but we'll also blast you out of space if you get out of line.
Yeah.
So the whole senior staff is like, okay, all right, I guess so. What happened to the captain? You know, and Achiev is like, they've been reassigned. Anyways, moving on. And they're just like, okay. And she goes, you know, do you guys know Captain Jellicoe? And they're like, well, I think, you know, I might have heard. And she just
no time. He's coming in. You're like,
my question is, why did you ask the question? You didn't want to answer to that. So we didn't need to ask that question. You could have just said, guess what? Captain Jellicoe is the new captain. Like, we didn't need to ask a rhetorical question in this context.
It really kind of felt like, kids, your dad and I. Oh, and this is your new dad.
Yes. You're like, wait, what was the end of the first sentence? Wait a minute.
I don't know. I don't know, David, if you or any of our listeners are a fan of The Office. I'm a huge fan of The Office. And at one point, there's a crisis. And Michael, who's the branch manager, is like, double time. We need to step on this. No time. No time. Anybody tries answering questions. And he's like, no time. No time. Right. And so that was what was ringing in my ears the entire episode where they're like, Captain Jellicoe, if you could just explain, no time. It's like, geez. Okay.
But do you have a minute to? No. Oh, okay. Well.
And how dare you even ask? Okay.
Yeah. Ooh, we get a couple. We get like such a wonderful punchable face in this episode. So she's like, Captain Jellicoe's coming. He's your new dad. You're all dismissed. And they're like, yes, sir. Okay. So they kind of leave. And then Riker's like, excuse me. on that note, what? And she's like,
I'm the assistant branch manager. And she goes, assistant to the branch manager.
That's right. That's yeah. right. Which is not
I'm
a role.
Bringing somebody else
You made
in.
That role up. And you can't, no, you can't take charge. So he's just like, huh? And Nechayev is like, look, I get you're the second in command. That's nice. But we need someone who is an expert in dealing with the Cardassians. And buddy, that's not you. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, but did you have to have all that attitude on it? I don't think so, Nechayev. You could have just said that in a professional way.
You know, I feel really judgy when I say this, but I never liked her. Okay.
I'm going to have to Google it because I feel like we've seen her before, like maybe in the cutest episode or something, but I can't point
she
it.
She for sure isn't there it. A lot. I mean, she comes up several times because he's trying to be nice to her and offers her some scones and some, and she's in DS9.
Oh,
as well. She comes back, yeah.
As the same person, the same character?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's
neat. Oh, interesting.
That's neat.
But, okay. You know, also on the other hand of that, like, I never cared for her, but I do love to see that Starfleet doesn't quibble over putting women in management as well. Because,
yeah,
you know,
awesome.
That's really, like, in the, you know, it's a military organization, which nobody aboard the Enterprise seems to know about,
no,
especially in this, and especially in this, like, episode where they're like, we have to cut power to all the research, whatever. And Jellicoe's like, dude, this is not a research vessel. Like, we're about to go to war. Like, Geordi, come on, man.
I thought that scene was really funny where Geordi's all like, but, you know, we'll have to cut, like, the Arboretum. They won't have power. It's like Teddy.
Forward, the ballroom dancing
oh,
class
no,
on Wednesday
forward,
night.
Forward's going to have power. But the holodeck
Guinan's blenders
power.
Won't work.
Yeah.
Guinan's blenders won't work. And we can't make a Coco No-No.
We can't make any Coco No-No. So shouldn't we keep the power on? It's like, what are you talking about? But this is the problem, though, which we'll get into as we go through the episode, is that Captain Jellicoe is the type of leader who only tells people what to do, but he never tells them why. So that's why people are asking questions like, hey, but we'll have to cut power to all these other things. But if Captain Jellicoe started with, we are going into a battle scenario, so we're going to act as if we're in battle right now. We're only going to keep on critical systems. We're only going to have power to shields and weapons. We're going to cut all. If he started with that, then it'd be like, oh, okay. So all of these other things, we'll tell all the departments, you're all closed. We're going to, you know what I mean?
Yep.
But instead he just goes, reroute this, reroute that, do it now. And they're like, but
see, this is a conversation that could have taken 45 seconds to explain. And then the crew's like, got it. I have a really big problem with people in management who are the never complain, never explain type. Because you're like, well, if you want me to do this and you want me to understand sort of like why I'm doing this, understanding does not come before communication. You need to communicate to me. I mean, even in some minor stuff, it's like, hey, Geordi, I understand we have to cut power to stuff, but we're going into like a potential war. So, you know, I'm going
to
really need you to anything
like,
you
why.
See that is extraneous, just cut power. You don't have to check with me every time. Not only does that save time, but Geordi now is like brought into the fold
He's
without
empowered.
Being told some like super secret plans. It's like, come on, Jellicoe.
Right. Because you don't have
come
to
come on anybody in management
plans.
Who doesn't bother explaining shit. Do you understand how absolutely shitty that is? I hope you guys know. Anyway.
So I'm going to jump this in here. I was going to wait till maybe even sometime later. Well, anyway, cut that out. I want to drop this in here. These two episodes are about control.
Mm,
yes.
Ooh, that's a powerful word. That is so
and
true.
Not even about leadership. He's got poor leadership skills, but he
Terrible.
Wants to maintain control.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you don't bring other people, like you were saying, when you don't bring other people into understanding that just because you want to control it, it's because if you let any piece of information out, they may be able to outmaneuver you. You think that they're going to outmaneuver you and look better than you. That's when
you're
the control.
So right. And, you know, I love the moment where we're jumping ahead a bit, but where Riker is like, well, he sure seems sure of himself, you know, and Troy's like, he's not. And she's the perfect person to say that because she can sense his emotions and how unsure he is. But you're absolutely right. People who try to maintain strict control at all times usually are the ones who are like on the verge of falling apart any second anyway, You know what I mean? So that's why they feel the need to have such strong control over things, because otherwise they can't function. So you're right. Like, Jellicoe has terrible management and leadership skills. Like, they're non-existent.
Yeah. And I have a question for you guys about Jellicoe that I will drop at the very end of this episode. So stay tuned.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Okay. So at this point in the episode, we're talking all this trash about Jellicoe. We haven't actually met him yet. At this part of the episode, he pops up in the transporter. Riker's waiting for him. And he springs off the transporter pad like a freaking Energizer bunny. And he's like, Riker, da-da-da-da. And he knows all the stuff about Riker, like where he lived, where he grew up, what his mama's name is, just all this stuff he knows. And then he's like, let's go. And so you're thinking like, okay, cool. Like, this guy's well-informed. He seems very enthusiastic. You know, it seems extremely positive in this first interaction. And then he starts barking out all of these orders. And Riker's like, yes, 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 okay. And then he jumps into a turbo lift and he's like, where's my quarters? And he's like, it's room seven, whatever, on the seventh floor. He's like, yeah, the seventh floor, I got it. And he leaves. And you just see Riker like standing in the dust. And it's like, that was some kind of whirlwind experience of having a new boss. Like, I couldn't imagine that kind of experience in a 9-to-5 job where you get a new boss and they come in and they do all that within 2 minutes. They give a bunch of orders and then they storm off and you're like, do you mean like now? Hello?
Yeah.
You know, but this kind of gives you an idea of the kind of leadership to expect from Jellicoe.
And I think in the purview of this episode, there is a time crunch because they, you know, they've got to meet with the Cardassians and they've got to do a thing. We know that, but let's take it back to real life. A lot of times when people come in like that again, it's because they don't want to let down the person above them.
Yes. They have pressure as
well.
And
they're afraid and they're scared. And again, they don't feel like they need to take the time to communicate with that with you. The more you know.
See, we don't even need a sound effect for that, Andrea. David's got us covered. That's what voice artists do, people.
Right? Saves me having to find that sound effect now. Cool.
That exact sound with that timbre and everything. So that's a really good point, because Jellicoe is in a time crunch. Like, there is a time pressure here. But again, it's like the super secrecy that just makes it feel frenetic and unsafe as opposed to urgent. It feels just crazy. Instead of urgent, to me, at least.
I was just thinking, you know, I feel bad for the crew because they're used to having it a certain way with their previous captain, you know, but this is the military. Stuff like this happens all the time. And people, you signed up for the military, whether it's exploration military or adventure military or guns blazing military, that's what you signed up for. So you are at the whims and mercy of Starfleet Command, and where they order you to go, you go. And if they order a command change, that's what happens. And it's sucky, especially when you have years of like trust built up with your commanding officer. Mm-hmm. But this kind of stuff happens. And at this point, I honestly don't think that Jellicoe is particularly punchable in this episode. I think it's next episode where I think he's like really awful. But this one, he's just like, he's actually taking the time to listen. Like, Deanna comes to talk to him. Riker tries to talk to him. Geordi tries to talk to him. And he's not being an asshole, but he's just like, look, just get it done. Like, I don't want to talk about it. I can't explain. I just need you to do it, you know? And that is challenging, but I don't think that he handles it terribly. It's next week where I'm like, dude, what the F, you know, but we'll get into that next week.
Yeah, now, I disagree. I feel like he is a jerk every time he responds to people. And I feel like he doesn't listen. He listens in the sense that he hears words coming out of their mouth and then he immediately dismisses whatever they says or cuts them off and tells them, I don't want to hear it. This isn't a discussion. I said what I said. Now do it. And to me, that's not listening. I mean, I guess we're like, you know, pulling hairs, but I don't feel like,
I mean, he's not splitting hairs. He's not a good listener. I think what I meant to say is like he seems to like take in what people are saying, but he's already decided before they come to talk to him that he doesn't have time. So he's like, okay, thank you for telling me that. We're still doing the thing I initially said we were going to do, but thank you for coming.
Like, yeah, but does he say thank you? No. Like, he's just like, do
maybe
it.
Not.
And he just, I don't know. He just feels really dismissive, but I think he's a punchable face overall. But
David, by the way, we're making a punchable faces of Starfleet bingo sheet with like Remick.
It currently has like 30 people on the bingo. I know, like, so many. Yeah. There's so much on the bingo.
So many.
And I feel like he also has redeeming qualities. Like, some of our other punchable faces were just like Remick, we're totally done with him. Airlock that bad boy.
Yeah.
But this guy, he has a lot of redeemable qualities, and I would not want him to be my boss. So both things are true.
No, absolutely not.
So
absolutely not.
Sorry, Ronnie Cox, who is this character, I don't know if you did any background on him. He he is hitting this moment in his career. Okay. Ronnie Cox, the actor, not Captain Jellicoe, the person, the character. Mm-hmm. Ronnie Cox had just come off of maybe 5 or 6 years ago, in like an 85, he was the main bad guy in RoboCop.
Oh my God. That's where I know him from.
He was the main bad guy.
He looked familiar and I couldn't place him. It was
RoboCop. He was the main bad guy on Mars in Total Recall.
He was totally in Total Recall.
So he has played the punchable face so many times.
It's ingrained in his DNA. Yeah.
And so he does it so well. And that's what was so impressive about him coming on and just, because we watch actors, and I'm not an actor, but when you watch actors and you hate them, they're a great actor.
They're killing it.
Yes, they're doing an amazing job. That's what I love about these two episodes is they're really triggering. They're very upsetting. They're very disturbing. And it's a credit to the brilliance of the writers, the actors, the directors, the producers, sets, costume, lighting, hair, makeup, everything, you know, that created that feeling in me watching this, even though I know like how it ends. One of the scenes that we actually skipped over was that Beverly Worf and Picard are training their butts off, right? And Picard cannot tell the other two where they're going or what they're doing. And they're doing this training and a Cardassian jumps out at them as they're running through these caverns. And they're like, computer freeze program. So obviously it's a holodeck simulation that they're doing training. And they all have like these cool hoods on. Now, I want to give major shout out. I was going to say major props to the costume department, but I feel like that's two different departments. But like major kudos to costuming. I have a good friend who's done a lot of costuming. And she's done some costuming, I believe, for even the Star Trek movie. The ones with Chris Pine and all, you know, like the more recent movies. She's done Kill Bill, she's done Black Panther costume. I mean, she's done a lot of big stuff. And she was talking to me and she's really shy and doesn't like how she sounds on microphones. So she's like, no, I won't come on the show, but I will, you can pick my brain. One of the real difficulties of creating very simple uniforms is that if you don't do it right, it ends up just looking like athleisure or like athletic wear, right? Like black yoga pants and like a black hoodie or whatever, right? So they're wearing all black. And like, since speaking to her, now I see these things differently. They're wearing all black and these kind of cool hoods that almost look like the surgical, like the red surgical hoods that they use when Picard had to have a heart transplant. And I was like, God, that looks like some sort of like spy ninja outfit, but it doesn't look like it should have a Nike logo on it or anything. Like they just do such a great job that I was like, wow, this is, I mean, I love it. Also, I love that the hood for Worf, his eyebrows like come out way past the hood. And I was like, were his eyebrows always that big? Man,
they were.
That hood really brings out his eyebrows, let me tell you.
Which is what all good hoods do. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that, that these outfits do totally look like spy ninja. They don't look like athletic wear at all. And it fits in the scene so well that I didn't even notice. It just like, it's so seamless.
It was just perfect.
It was perfect. It was perfect. Yeah.
And I will say, I don't know if ninja is a word we can say or not. Like, I hope that it's not offending anybody or anything. But, you know, when I think about my childhood Halloween costumes that I saw the kids run around in, it was a lot of that kind of all black with just the, like a ski mask kind of with just your eyes. Now, I have a question here. Why don't you just have Data on the team? He's faster. He's stronger. He has all this information at the tip of his brain. I don't get why they wouldn't have Data on this.
Well, later on, they talk about why the three of them were chosen. I think it's possible to have four or to replace all three of them with Data because he could do all of their jobs.
Yeah,
we've established. But later on, they do talk about why those three specifically were chosen. I didn't think about that, but I agree with you. They could have had either added Data to the team or just literally had Data because he can do everything that all of them can do as one person and probably faster, but whatever. Yeah. We needed him for other things with Jellicoe. Well,
they say that they need Worf for obvious reasons because strength and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but if you need strength, like as we've seen in the Worf effect, he's not that strong because he's getting his ass handed to him by like literally every balls of energy, lore, Q.
Yeah, but they
Riker don't, sometimes like
they don't need
Deanna Troi when she was taken over by an electricity monster. I mean, yeah, come
that's
on.
True. That's true. Yeah, but they don't need
just
him for strength.
Data.
Like they say they need him for his security training and to infiltrate the base or whatever. We're going to talk about that a little later.
Yeah,
but but you're right. We could have had Data, would have added something to it. But having Data on the ship is better for the storytelling.
For the storytelling, yeah.
He's the only one who can deal with Jellicoe.
By the way, I love how we've been talking about this for 30 minutes and we're only on like minute five of the episode.
Yeah, I think we're like a good solid 2 minutes into the episode. So I don't know. If you're listening, I hope you have a drink and a snack.
Or like a long drive ahead of you or you're commuting somewhere.
Maybe break this up into a few different listenings over the week of the commute. Okay.
Next week's episode will be 4 minutes.
Right? It'll be like torture. And
we're out.
Yeah.
So next we're going to tend forward for this like transfer ceremony, which this is our first time and to my knowledge, our last time seeing this particular thing happen on TNG, which is very cool. Like they do this ceremony where Picard transfers command of the ship to Jellicoe. They're wearing their dress robes, their dress uniforms. And he transfers all command codes and Jellicoe's like, great, I take the ship. And you know, everybody in the room looks like their puppy just died. I mean, nobody's happy about this transfer.
Oh my God.
They're all looking at each other. Like, it looks like a wake. They're all looking at each other like,
yes.
Okay. And then you kind of see, you know, you see them exchange glances and Troy and Beverly kind of slide off to the side and Troy's like, oh, what's wrong? And Beverly's like, I'm really sore. And Troy just looks at her and Beverly goes, I know. I wish I could tell you, but I can't, which I love because she's super, not the empathic one.
Super secret. Yeah.
But she knows exactly from the look on Troy's face what she's thinking and feeling, which I really liked. And, you know, Picard and Jellicoe are kind of chit-chatting on the side. The whole ceremony takes like 18 seconds.
1 second. Yeah. It takes about as long as the intro. Yeah.
It's very short. But you see them kind of chit-chatting about what's coming up. And Jellicoe's like, okay, what do you need? And he's like, all right, well, you know, Picard's like, the latest intel would be great. So he's like, all right, when we get closer to the border, we're going to shoot out a probe. And the probe's telemetry is going to come back so that you can pick it up on the shuttlecraft, like on your way. And he's like, okay, cool. I got that. And as they're chit-chatting, he's like, okay, I'm going to have put Riker on that. But again, no explanations because we can't tell the super secret stuff, right? So he's like,
yeah,
all right, Riker, I want you to tell Data Shift to, or Delta Shift to send the probe and it's going to do XYZ. And Riker's like, yeah, about that. I want to talk to you about that because changing our shifts, you know, is going to cause a lot of hardship to the crew. And here's the part where I was like, where I felt like he was kind of a jerk about it, where he was just like, what? You didn't do what I told you to do.
Mm-hmm.
What are you talking about? You know, and he was just like,
by the way, the conversation to move from a 3-shift to a 4-shift system and the ceremony was like 15 minutes. Are you seriously telling me you expect a giant crew shift to happen in like 15 minutes and then be mad that it hasn't happened yet? And he does say like, just get it done. I don't want to talk about it. It's like, okay.
Yeah, because Riker's like, I want to talk to you about this later, you know, and how we can basically, how can we come up with a compromise? How can we make this happen, but not like in the next 3 minutes? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's when he's just like, I don't want a conversation. Do it. Get it done. And tell Delta Shift to do what I said to do. And Riker's just like, yes, sir. And you're like,
By the way, thinking about the logistics behind it, you know, let's say you have 10 people on 3 shifts. So it's like 3, 3, and 3. And like you have a floater as a spare or something. How do you divvy that up all of a sudden between 4? Now it's like, wait.
It's going to suck because you're either going to pull people who were like off shift and put them on this new shift. And it's going to suck. Everyone's
or somebody's shift is going to be like a 20-hour
super
shift.
Long.
Or, it's like, what do you, okay.
But Jellicoe doesn't care. He doesn't care about that. Get it done. And like, I get it. Again, there's this urgency, but it's just coming across as like demanding. But really, it's coming from a place of, we need this done yesterday because we might be going to war tomorrow.
And I'm going to go back to leadership things. That's the way he likes things done.
Yeah.
But that's not the way the current smoothly running teams operate.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not recognizing and realize this is a story plot. We get it. But.
But this is how a lot of people are in management.
Yeah.
Yes, but to go in and just shake things up for the sake of shaking things up, you all of a sudden. Everybody's confused. Everybody doesn't know. They don't know what, not that we're trying to be comfortable, but that we're trying to do the best job we can.
Yeah.
And you're just stirring the pot.
They don't know what to expect. And I think that's the biggest thing in management is setting clear expectations.
Yes.
Here's what I expect. And then you check out how are you doing with what I expect? This is what, so everybody knows what the playing field is, what the rules are, so we can all do a good job. But this is keeping people on their toes and changing everything up so they never know what to expect. So they don't know if they're doing a good job or not. And that is a crappy feeling as a worker because you feel like you're always failing. At least I'll say that for myself because I had a boss very similar to Jellicoe and not so snappy and stuff, but like just similar in the sense of like not very good. And it was extremely frustrating to not have clear objectives or goals or expectations. And then to be chewed out if anything went quote unquote wrong. But how could it be wrong when you never told me what right was, which is so frustrating.
Oh yeah.
To me.
Yeah. I mean, I've had managers who have done that where they're like, XYZ should be happening and you're not doing it. And you're like, okay, let me go ahead and do that. And then you do it and they're like, why is XYZ happening? That shouldn't be happening. It's like, you just told me yesterday. Like, and that kind of lack of
awareness,
expectation, lack of awareness, lack of some sort of stability is extremely dysregulating. It's really frustrating because if you don't know what's expected of you, how are you supposed to work well? You know what I mean? And then you just get a bunch of negative feedback and you're like, I literally just did the thing you told me to do yesterday. And now you don't. Yeah. So that, I mean, that is really, really poor leadership. Now at this point, Deanna kind of comes to speak with him and she's like, hey, how you do, Angelico? Let's chat. You know, me and Picard sort of had this nice little informal thing where I can come talk to him when he was effing up, which was never, and like talk, you know?
And so I'd love to keep that going with you.
So Deanna comes to speak with him about the changes and how the crew's adjusting and they're really uncertain how to react. Angelico understands how unsettled everyone must feel. And he's like, and Deanna was like, they may just need time, like time to adjust, time to get to know you, time for you to get to know them.
Can I just give so many golden stars to Troy in this scene. I was like, so you may have heard us talk about therapy many, many times on this show. You know, everyone, if you're listening to this episode, you've probably heard us talk about that. And I recently started seeing a therapist thanks to Andrea's encouragement. And as I'm in watching this scene, I'm like, I kind of want her to be my therapist too. Like, I just loved, she was like, just making so much sense. She was not judgmental. Mm-mm. She was not, she never is. Was wrong. She never is, but like, I would be, right? Like, I totally would be, right? And she just was, when she was talking to him, I felt like she was so understanding and she wasn't judging. She wasn't criticizing. She was just saying, I think we all need time to get to know each other, as opposed to like, what the F are you doing? What are you doing? Right? Like, she just came at him so professionally and with so much kindness. And I was just floored. Like, I wanted her to be my therapist. Sorry, please continue, Andrea.
She I just want
to
jump amazing. In and be like, oh, I mean, I it was just, scene. It was just the Michael Scott from The Office going, no time. We don't have time for that. We don't have time to get to know anybody. You know, we're on an urgent mission, which at this point, I still like Jellico because I don't think he's being a jerk. I do know that he's under tremendous pressure from Starfleet Command to be like, listen, Jellico, we're throwing you into the blender and you need to make 100 margaritas in a minute. And he's like, you know, he's trying to just do it all as quickly as he can with the conceit that like we're going to war. What is like surely about to be a war. We're going to this like kangaroo court bullshit negotiation that we know is going to fail. And when it fails, we're going to war. And we just don't have time to be worrying about our feelings right now, which I completely understand. Yeah. And that's why I think it's hard for the crew. But I also sympathize with Jellico because it's like, Jellico, you're going to war and you're commanding a whole new team and you got to whip everybody into shape. And we're all not going to be doing walks through the Arboretum and all this crap.
But that's
like,
why
war, you know,
that's why like, we need this team, though. That's why he needs Troy. That's why he needs Riker, because if you were going into a war, you want a team that trusts you
and
listens to you. He is not garnering anyone's favor to listen to him or to trust that he knows what he's talking about.
He is the fire alarm.
Yes. Yes.
The fire alarm doesn't care how you feel. The fire alarm doesn't care what's going on, that you're in the middle of the meeting. The fire alarm says, get the Hades out of the building or you're going to be in Hades.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think that that's really, I mean, granted, it seems like Starfleet Command was acting on the information as quickly as they had it. Yeah. But it seems like a boo-boo on, like, Starfleet Command's behalf.
It's just an emergency situation.
So you gave this guy this, like, huge mission that's really dangerous that probably could lead
to
death.
And you gave it to him yesterday.
You gave it to him with 18 seconds to prep. So I understand. It's like, I don't have time for your feelings. Yes, everything would work more smoothly if I knew you, if you knew me, if I had time to garner your trust. There's no time. Like, I think I would be like Jellico in the same situation. It's like, that all sounds great. I love that. And there's literally no time to be worrying about feelings. Just do all your job and let's try to get out of here. You know?
That's fair. I still vote him to be on the most punchable faces. I mean, but let's wait till the end of next week's episode.
After next week's episode, I'm like, let's put him right in the center square, okay? The torturer can be like slightly off to the left. Like, let's put Jellico in the center. Now, Geordi's venting to Riker, which I love to see because it's really important to be able to have,
right?
Yeah, it shows the trust. It's important to have somebody above you that you can pass the buck to, you know, but like, obviously Riker has Geordi's trust where Jellico doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I love that Riker, and I have seen this in management as well. And I have worked with managers like this who are like Riker, who'll be like, listen, I'm with you. I'm just as frustrated as you are. And to be honest, between you and me, they're not listening to me either. And I've had managers like that. And the managers have always been apologetic for being like, I'm sorry, I don't want to burn. It's like, no, that actually lets me know that I'm not alone. Like, I appreciate this, because if I'm just dealing with one robot after the other, nobody in this group seems human. This is incredibly frustrating, as opposed to Riker being like, dude, I'm right there with you. If you can get him to listen, you tell me, because he's not listening to me either. And it's like,
I really appreciated this scene for those exact same reasons. And you're right. I've also had a manager in the past very similar to Riker who's like, yeah, I hear you. And if I could do anything, I would. And I can't. And even that, just that transparency of being like, I'm in charge, sort of, but not really. Like, I'm not in charge like I thought I was. I'm not in charge like I was yesterday when Picard was in charge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'll do my best. I really appreciate that. And then when Geordi's like, can I make a suggestion? Like, even the fact that he asked and didn't just say, like, you need to do something, Riker, right? He said, can I make a suggestion? And Riker's like, yes. Like, all this, like, back and forth agreement just felt so good to my little soul. But he's like, yeah.
And Geordi's like, can you go tell old dad?
Yeah. That new dad is being mean to me and took my Xbox. Stepdad
sucks.
Yeah. Like, stepdad won't let me go to the party. Can you go tell him? And Riker, to his credit, is like, yeah, I'll do that.
It's good dad, bad dad. Yeah. And Riker goes to see Picard, who Picard is drenched in sweat in his super cool all black outfit, sweating on his little bald pate, like in his chair. Poor guy, like barely moving.
Exhausted.
And here is Sir Patrick Stewart at 60 some odd years, looking so incredible. I mean, I just turned 40 last year, and I'm like in 90% worse shape than Sir Patrick Stewart. I was like, what the? He just looks so great. You know, he looks, it's really impressive. But Riker,
Andrea is
actually like,
in good shape, by the way. She's like she's like Little Miss riding a bike, taking my like dog for a run, not a walk, because that's what normal people do. No, me and my dog, we run, sure.
We do.
So that's really saying something about Sir Patrick
Stewart.
I mean,
it doesn't hurt that she's a puppy and she can run like a zillion miles. So I'm like, that's probably good. Anyway, Riker's like, you know what? It's not important. I'm sorry to bother you. Good night. And I'm just loving that even Riker, you know, sometimes when you work with kids or you have kids of your own and they're really worked up, they'll come in and be like, Dad, guess what? All these things are out. But like, they don't take that second to be like, gosh, your arm is off and you're bleeding horribly. Are you okay? Like, it's just like they've got tunnel vision. And I was like, yay, Riker, good for you to be like, I've got, you know what?
He read the room.
Yeah, I'm reading the room really well. Like, snaps,
he respects his
snaps
friend.
To Riker.
Yeah. He respects his friend. Yeah. And he's like, it's not an emergency. Don't worry about it. And it's not an emergency. It's just really frustrating. So, yeah, that was a beautiful scene. So next thing you know, we're in the ready room and Picard and Jellicoe are kind of going over final details before Picard, Beverly, and Worf hop in their shuttlecraft and go away to certain doom. So they're chit-chatting and Picard, they mentioned Riker, and it's very clear that Jellicoe is not a fan of Riker. And he's just like, he's your first officer, huh? Like, just, he's just very like not a fan. And Picard's like, you know, I think if you just, he's the finest, one of the finest officers I've ever served with. I think if you just took a little time, had a little patience and got to know him, you would come to agree with me that he's amazing. To which Jellicoe said, as he's been saying, I don't have time for that. I don't have time to know anybody.
Time.
And then he says, and not to be blunt, but the Enterprise is my ship now. Like, you can't tell me what to do. You know, I'm the new stepdad. And you're like, all right, buddy. That okay. You're taking this to your head just a bit. But okay, that's true. It is your ship now, but you might want to hear from the person who had the ship for like all the years before you, but whatever. You don't have time. Fine. So that's how that ends on kind of a weird note. And then as he's walking out, Jellicoe's like, hey, isn't this yours? And gives him this giant book that you always see Picard reading when he's in his ready room. And it was like the last vestige of Picardness in the ready room, because he'd already gotten rid of the fish. You know, lose the fish in the ready room. What do we need to get fish for? Which is like, yeah, you
Which,
don't need
by
a fish,
the way,
but also why does it need to be? Is it that bothersome? That fish in the wall is really like throwing off your game.
That I always wonder, how do they feed that damn fish? Because I'm like,
they just
no
like replicate flakes into the
something
right in
the bowl. Yeah.
You mentioned this a few episodes ago. It's the transporter. That's how they got it in the bowl. That's how they feed it.
Maybe it's the fish. Maybe it's the fish that Barkley was seeing in the transport beam that was like getting stuck or something, and not that creepy silkworm. Yeah.
Maybe it's a holographic fish. And yes. You don't need to feed it. So many options, but Jellicoe was not having Riker or the fish.
Which, by the way, when Picard says goodbye to Jellicoe, and Jellicoe hands him the giant Shakespeare book or whatever it is that he's reading, he says, "Good hunting." And I was like, wow, they say that on Battlestar Galactica all the time as well. And it made me wonder if that's a military thing. I didn't look it up because, like, just so much was happening in the episode. I was like, it's too minor. So I'm wondering if you are in the military, have been in the military, know anybody who has been in the military, or just a fan of military history like myself, is good hunting a military kind of common phrase? Because I feel like it probably might should be. or might be. Also,
so if you know, listen, DM us on Instagram at the TNG podcast and educate and enlighten us.
Thank you, because I always want to know more. I got to say, I understand that Jellicoe has this son that's like in kindergarten or whatever, but like,
she did son in air quotes, by the way.
I did son in air quotes, which is like, we all know it's his grandson, but Jellicoe's got an ego problem and has to call him son. I don't know. I don't care. But the point is, there are now little kid like finger paintings splattered all over the wall behind him. And I was like, you couldn't order that in any sort of way. It's just shocking. It's like his son was in the ready room and it's like, we'll put this one here, we'll put this one there. I was like, man, this room looks butt ugly now, Jellicoe. You were upset about a fish in the wall and you've got paintings that you can't even tell what your son has painted and they're just sprayed everywhere like a shotgun blast. I was like, this is what you've been spending your time doing when you keep saying there's no time to get to know the team and you're tacking these paintings up all over the wall. Give me a break. I was really annoyed by that, by the way. I was like, that's so ugly.
I think that goes to story and backstory with him. I mean, because that gives him, because number one, he was on the Cairo, which we assume it was the ship that was dropping him off, which was a Excelsior class.
Yeah, it's a smaller one.
Much smaller, which does not have families, which means his family was not with him, which means they're back at the house.
Mm.
And so this is how he does dad. Out in space.
It's the refrigerator.
It is.
There's no refrigerators in space. So like you got to put those pictures somewhere, I guess.
Space is the refrigerator.
That's right. So that's what that's how they're trying to give him a juxtaposition with this hard, callous exterior that we're seeing.
Yeah. Also, I love my kid.
He really loves his kid.
Yeah.
He really does.
But, you know, I think that also, like to your point, David, of that this episode's really about control, not really leadership. Mm-hmm. Contrasting Jellicoe with Gul Madrid from the next episode, that's it, because he also has a child and he also loves his child. And there's this comparison of like, but I have a kind side too to other people, you know, or to certain people. So then I'm not all bad, right? And it's like, I guess, I don't know. I guess that's a question that we're asking with this episode. But that happens. The ready room is officially cleared out of all Picardness. And it has been sterilized.
All the Earl Grey has been
removed from the replicators. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now it's only scotch and gin and tonic.
You can't even get an Earl Grey. Yeah. You can't even get an Earl Grey on the ship anymore.
Yeah. It just says access denied on the panel.
No, it says you have to ask Jellicoe personally.
And then there's no time to talk about it. You know, one of the things that I do appreciate that Jellicoe says, and I don't like the way he says it, but it gives us as viewers sort of a sense of the urgency of this mission, is he says, listen, you know, you're busy trying to vouch for Riker and Geordi and the whole team. I need to tell you what's going on here. The Cardassians will not listen to reason. We're going into war and the chances are very high that you won't be coming back from this mission. Okay. So like, I don't have time to be giving Will Riker or anybody else a chance. And the Enterprise is mine now. So I'm going to have to do as I see fit, whatever, you know, but just saying the chances are high, you're not coming back. It's like, oh my God, like Picard, Worf and Crusher are quite probably heading to their death, you know, and they actually do take off. And now is the time when Picard can say, okay, finally, I can tell you guys the briefing now that we're underway. Starfleet Intelligence believes that the Cardassians are developing a metagenic weapon, which is a very cool word. And Worf is us as the viewer. He's like, I'm not familiar with that. You know, which of course, Beverly's like, my God, you know, we're like, what is that?
Not a metagenic weapon.
Yeah. And we're like, what is that? Dun, dun. Yeah. It's like, what does this mean? It's a genetically engineered viruses that can destroy the entire ecosystem. They seek out and destroy all organic life within weeks. And then within a few weeks after that, the mutagenic weapon dissipates, leaving the planet free for conquest, which reminds me a lot of like an EM pulse or something like that. You know what I mean? That like just knocks out all the technology and then like you can go in. Yeah,
like a biological EM pulse.
Right? Yes.
It just knocks out all living things.
Electromagnetic pulse.
Which is interesting because, I mean, the whole idea of this, as a microbiologist, I was like, what? Like, the whole idea of this is really interesting. Yeah, it does leave the structures intact and all the abiotic or non-living things would still be there. But without any living things, all the technology would be there. The space would be there. But without living things, I would argue that that space is no longer habitable. If you don't have plants, you don't have oxygen. If you don't have algae in the water, like if you don't have any living thing of any kind, that space exists, but it's not livable. You'd have to make like a biodome around it and put in all the artificial stuff. It might be better to create some kind of genetic weapon that only attacks the humans, like whoever specifically the species is.
Specifically designed for the to like whoever you're targeting. Yeah.
But this one just knocks out all DNA of all kind. Yeah. So Warp points out, like, isn't that just as dangerous to the person deploying it as it is to the person getting it deployed on them, because it destroys all DNA of any living thing? And they're like, yeah, that's why it was banned. Like, not even the, you know, such and such people do it. Like, not even the worst people do it. Like, nobody does this kind of research because it's so dangerous.
The Cardassians do not abide by the Geneva Convention. Okay. They're all about that bioterrorism. Yeah. And they do say, like, well, we think that they're launching dormant mutagenic viruses in a subspace wave that won't be detected. So that way there's no risk of exposure to the Cardassians. They did not have to write these lines, but they did. And that backstory is what makes it so good.
It makes it really believable. And you're like, oh, crap. So they could really do this.
So we are now fearing, as viewers, a made up technology that we're like, oh my God.
And that's devastating.
That's the power of incredible writing, and like such huge props to Frank Abbademarco and the whole writing team who did this and the rewrites and everything, because yes, we are totally terrified.
Yeah, we buy it. It tracks.
Yeah, it tracks, and we see like planet-wide destruction, genocide as a possibility of the Cardassians, and we wouldn't put it past the Cardassians either way.
We wouldn't put anything past these mofos. So we find out here why these three people were chosen.
Sorry, that's like my favorite line of ever that you've ever said. We wouldn't put anything past these mofos.
We need a t-shirt that says that. I've already decided for our next podcast, every episode, we're designing a t-shirt. I've already decided. So that's
I did not know about this, but now you know. I'm super on board. Yeah. I want a picture of a Cardassian and it says, don't put anything past this mofo.
For our next podcast, not for this one. You know, there's all the like IP situation.
Yeah.
But so here's where we find out why these three and only these three were selected. So something about these mutagenic weapons depend on theta wave bands for some reason. Okay, whatever. Doesn't matter. We believe it. And
it's Picard, the mechanism upon which they launch them, because they're really non-detectable. It shows up in scans as background radiation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So Picard, apparently this was his thesis project or something. He's like an expert in this one thing that we now discover, which works for me. He's an expert in this. So that's why he was brought along, because he knows all about the theta bands. He knows all about that. We also have Worf, because he's the specialist in security and he can get them into tight corners because they're going to infiltrate this base. Their mission is to infiltrate the base to see if these weapons are really being made. And if so, to destroy the base by any means necessary. So that's where Worf comes in to like sneak them in and set up the charges and blow stuff up. That's what he's going to do, which yay Worf. Then we have Beverly, in case there's any biological agents that need to be contained or that could potentially escape. She's there to find the mutagenic weapon and completely disable it, which good luck figuring out how to do that. But that's why we have these three people. And you're like, okay, like, because I was wondering, why is their way team so freaking small? Like, I know they're trying to be undetected, but like, they could throw in like two more people. But when you hear this, you're like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you're trying to sneak in these underground caverns. So it's like, you need to keep your numbers down. But out of three people, if you lose one, 33% of your crew is gone. Like that's...
Yeah. It seems a little...
Yeah.
It seems a little sparse. But I'm not a military strategist.
Can we make it four or five? Like...
Yeah. I feel like five's a better, you know, because at least we have two people to carry the one injured person. If two people... I don't know. Whatever. But I'm not a military strategist. So that's what they decided to go with. So we're like, okay, cool. So we find out that they can't just take their shuttle to the planet where they think this weapon is being made, because it's a Federation shuttle and the planet is actually right across the border.
Yeah, Celtris 3 is in Cardassian space.
It's in Cardassian space. So they're like, how are we going to get over there without causing a conflict or having people spot us or whatever? And Picard's like, aha, I've got something for that. So then I wrote in my notes, not another cantina.
That's what I thought. That's what I said. I wrote on Tormund 5, we end up in the cantina on Mos Eisley again.
Again. At least this time we don't have somebody playing the piano and singing a really weird Klingon tune. Wow.
They do find a Ferengi, and they say they're looking for Daemon Solak, and they're like, we're interested in transportation to Celtris 3. And that Ferengi's like, he's not a smuggler. He's not going to smuggle you there. And also, I know you're Federation spies. And as soon as he starts getting worked up about it, Beverly's like, actually, and turns on the feminine wiles. And I love that Picard and Worf are like, Beverly, are you there? Yeah.
The look on Michael Dorn's face, which I know he's acting, but the look on his face is just hilarious.
It's priceless. He's like, what is this? Also, human females don't do it for him. So he was like, ugh.
Well, that's what he says. That's what he says. But knows everybody he hooks up with, except for Kaelor, is like a human.
Yeah,
or a freaking
Trill. And Kaelor was half human. So
he was half human.
Yeah. So I don't know. He speaks a good game, but I don't really believe that whole human females are not for me kind of thing. Anyways, she turns on the charm. Daemon is like, yes, right away. And I was over this scene. I was already over it. Let's just get.
Yeah, I was like, we could have canceled that. We could have just been like, we're gonna.
We got a smuggler scatter and we got smuggled.
Whatever the F, we're gonna trek our shields out. We're just gonna get to Celtris 3. Like, they, we did not need this whole Tormund 5 nonsense. No,
they could have made a statement saying we're gonna find somebody who will smuggle us, and then the next scene they're in the caves. I would have been cool with that.
Yeah,
but you've got to fill two episodes of time.
But do we? Maybe they should have made this one episode. Maybe we didn't need to break it up. I'll tell you, anyways.
I would have been thankful if this was one episode, because next episode is just so traumatic and difficult to watch. I was like, I could have done with 90% less of this.
Yeah, next episode feels like a more complete story, though. Yes. But so I feel like, I don't know. If there was fluff to be cut out, it's honestly just that scene in the cantina. All the other stuff feels like it needs to be there. So. Yeah. I can't really criticize this one too much, but whatever. They show up in the caves, and apparently there are like bats in these caves. So that's good to know that alien planets and alien caves have alien bats. Sure.
Yeah. Facts and I me. Love that Worf, the man who had a pet targ, is afraid of a bat. I was like, buddy,
there's a big difference between a targ and a bat. You know, it's so funny because like I'm not afraid of bats. At least none of the bats I've ever seen were really scary. But I remember there's one time.
I love bats. I think they're awesome.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Well, you know what?
Really interesting and cool.
Well, because I love to camp. So when I'm camping at night, I have the kind of blood that mosquitoes love. So I'll come back from a camping trip with like 50 mosquito bites, and mosquitoes around here will eat bat. Well, the bats will eat the mosquitoes. And so when I have my campfire going at night and I'm sitting there relaxing, I'll see bats like swooping over the fire, because that's, you know, the mosquitoes are drawn to the light.
Yeah.
And so you just see them swooping and you can hear their little echolocation. It sounds like a little tittering sound.
Yeah.
It's so cool. And I'm like, oh, cool. And they never swoop down lower than like 20 feet above your head. So you never worry that like one's going to accidentally hit you or clip you or any. It's like, oh, they're so awesome. Now, on Celtris 3, the team is penetrating the underground caverns. Bev is picking up some subspace signals. It's quite hard to get a lock on them and whatnot. And then that's when we learn that Worf is afraid of bats. And the Enterprise rendezvous with the Cardassian ship. I'm so tempted, because of cultural lexicon, to say Cardassian, because it's so similar. So I have to keep catching myself.
But aren't they both so similar anyway? No.
I don't know. Golomet could be a lawyer. He had some really like good points that he made at the end of the episode.
But yeah, Golomek is in the observation lounge. Angelica's like, cool, cool, cool. I'll be in my ready room. And Deanna's like,
did you want to meet him in your ready room? Is that why you're going to your ready room?
Sort of, yeah,
and he's like, no, I just want to be in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And he says, I know that the Cardassians are trying to establish dominance by making Angelica wait and all this stuff. Like, this is a negotiation 101 tactic, you know, so you'd be the first to establish dominance or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, well, I'm going to just make him wait. So he sits there and tries to analyze the finger paintings on the wall. And I was like, you could be watching a fish, but you got rid of it. Instead, there's just a really boring houseplant in its place, which I was like, okay. Now, meanwhile, the team is like rappelling down 500 meters. And I was like, now this is my kind of fun right here.
Yeah. They and I wrote in my notes, hard pass.
Oh, no. I was like, let's do it.
Rappelling down a shit. So Andrea introduced me to rock climbing. So years ago, she and I would go climbing like a bunch. Like I was climbing a couple times a week.
Yeah.
And the one thing that was always tough for me was the rappelling. Like if I was on an auto belay, which is like a little, it's like a seat belt and it lets you down really slowly. I was like, wee, you know, rappel all day long because it's kind of a fun little ride. And if someone was belaying me, like Andrea, if she had me up by a rope, then I felt comfortable because I knew she wasn't going to drop me. But yeah. If it was anyone else, I'd be like, no, I'm good. Like, I don't know. I just, this idea of me dangling from a rope at the top of a, it just was not my cup of tea. So yeah, when they were like,
it was like a 30, 40 foot wall. So it's a good height. But to be fair,
and
though,
this was hundreds of feet. I don't know. This was just, I was
500 meters.
I'm
so it was
good.
Five
super
football
good.
Fields in length. Yep.
1,500 feet. Half of El Capitan.
Yes, it is half of El Cap, which is has always been one of my dream climbs. But to be fair, Charisse, all climbers are like that about their belays. Because I've had some really bad belays that have like let me crash into the wall and I almost broke my knee doing that.
Oh my gosh.
So unless I would only climb on lead climbing with like two or three people that I really trusted. That was it. So it's not just you.
So let me ask you, Andrea, and you, David, in this scene where they have to rappel down this cliff and they put those spikes into the ground.
It's hydraulic like, pitons.
Yeah. And they like stick them into the ground. Would you do that?
David, you're our guest. I'll have you answer first.
Well, I think you call them fusion pitons. And so if you can fuse.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they look
metal
like.
To
they
rock,
look fused. Yeah.
They might be pretty sturdy. They're not going to hold me either way.
that's not true.
Function is to hold you. So we're assuming they're going to hold you and you won't die. Would you do it?
I've never done it, so I couldn't really answer it properly. Maybe.
I would absolutely do it, but this particular scene really bothered me when they use the fusion pitons to go. First of all, he said it's pure granite, which I was like, cool, granite exists on other planets. That's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Granite is like one of the hardest rocks to climb. When you set anchors in it, it's like, you know, it's not going anywhere. It's not like trying to do it in like talc powder or something. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing that really bothered me. Any climber worth their salt knows that redundancy is the name of the game. So you just use just one piton. Are you serious? You need at least two in case one fails or something. And I was like, come on, Picard. Also, those pitons are the size of like a camping tent stake. You could pack two.
Yeah, we're gonna hard pass and we're gonna cheer Andrea on and make sure she's using two of those pitons.
Maybe five, maybe a couple,
maybe just transport down there because we're not
maybe
in a war.
Transport down.
But
yeah.
In any case, they're doing all this cool stuff. And now we kind of have this like two-pronged thing going on where we're going back and forth between the Enterprise and the cave. On the Enterprise, Jellicoe is negotiating with Gol-Lamech. And he has all these little tricks up his sleeve for how to maintain dominance. And this is the part where Andrea was talking about earlier. Like, he keeps him waiting for over an hour. Then he storms into the observation lounge. And when Gol-Lamech complains that he's been waiting for over an hour, he storms back out. Like, fine, you just can't be civilized. And he storms back out. And you're like, what the F? And Riker and Troy are like,
this
so
was
confused.
Like loose cannon 101 right here. Yeah,
they're so confused. So they come out and they're on the.
I missed that class.
Maybe it was loose cannon 102. Well, anyways.
Okay. Maybe, yeah.
They come out on the bridge, and Riker and Troy are like, huh? And he's like, okay, great. We've got him on the ropes. And he's like, here's the plan. Let him stew for a few more minutes, and then go back in, and then make it seem like I'm so unhinged and so out of control. And he's going to say this, and you're going to say this, and he's going to say this. And at the end of the day, he's going to ask to have two aides on to match the two of you. So allow him to do that, but be really begrudging about it and make it seem like you just really had to twist my arm. And he's like, all right, go team. And he walks away like feeling
Captain
so happy.
Captain Picard would never.
He wouldn't do any of this. But I think it is really effective because the whole point is that Jellicoe knows all about the Cardassians more than anybody else. So that's why he picked this really out of the box strategy. Picard would have approached him the way Picard approaches absolutely everyone. Mm-hmm. And Jellicoe is approaching Cardassians exactly how he would approach Cardassians specifically. He's like the specialist, right? So Riker's like, all right, this is the moment when he's like, well, I'll give it to him. He's really confident. Like, he's got a plan. He feels really good about it. And that's when Troy's like, no, he's not. Like, he seems confident, but I can sense that he is quaking in his boots.
Yeah.
In any case, it works. It works. When we come back to the observation lounge, we see the two aides. We see they're having a conversation. All this time back in the cave, they're kind of making their way little by little to what they think is the test site. So let's take a minute in the observation lounge, and then we'll go back to what's going on.
Sure. Yeah, because it's a lot of back and forth.
It's a lot of back and forth. So I kind of want to finish up that part until the part where they get captured. And then it kind of like both stories coincide. Oh, no.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. They get captured or they get tricked or whatever. So in the observation lounge, Golamek is seated with his two aides. And Jellicoe storms back in with Riker and Troy and walks to the very, very, very opposite end of the table to sit down. And I thought to myself, can this table get any longer?
You know what
this
I thought
is not
to myself,
their standard table.
This is what I thought to myself. If you guys were eating dinner together, don't ask Golamek to pass the salt because it'd take like an hour to get it.
Yeah.
To you.
I was like,
it's such a long table.
Where did they get this table from? Anyways, it was great.
Also, I mean, it's a cool looking table. It's got these like weird kind of like granite sort of pylon things along this, but it also sort of curves. So you're not mm-hmm. even sitting across. You're sitting like across and to the left of
like
someone,
a banana.
Just, like,
it's like a
it is
curve.
A banana shaped mm-hmm. table, which is so random.
And very
but,
cool.
You know, I noticed
spacey.
That Jellicoe comes back in and he's a lot nicer. And he's like, thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. And Golamek is looking at his aides with the eyes wide like, what the F? Like, because
you know, he told
them
that
he was
crazy.
Such a dick. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like, it doesn't last super long. But I will say the Cardassians actually pull out this like ace card where they're like, we know about the spy team going to our sector. And if they succeed in whatever it is they're doing, it would be cause for a very serious response by the Cardassians. We wouldn't want that, right?
Yeah, the Cardassians.
And Jericho's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, this was so like non, like, I was just like, buddy, nobody's buying it, Jellicoe.
Yeah, the Cardassians do the thing that they do where they're like, threatening you with a big smile on their face.
Yes.
As if they're
with
doing
like
you some kind of favor.
Teeth.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, this is, once the Cardassians start smiling, you know you're in trouble. And that's what happens in the scene. And then Jellicoe's just like, I don't know what you're talking about. And Troy and Riker are looking at each other because they actually don't know what he's talking about. Like, yeah. They don't know, for real.
They have perfect plausible deniability. However, Jellicoe, his hands are dirty with this mission. He knows.
Yeah. So they're kind of like looking at each other and they're like, okay. And Jellicoe's like, I don't know what you're talking about. So we're like, that's really interesting. So then going back to the cave, they're climbing through rock. And, you know, Worf actually does kind of earn his stripes in this scene where Picard's like, okay, we need to get through this tunnel and we need to get to this other side. And can you make this little hole wider or whatever? And mm-hmm. Worf looks at it and goes, yes, a phaser setting of 6.5 or whatever is going to be exactly what's needed.
16.
He says phasers set to level 16 should suffice. And I was like, cool. At least now we know they go to at least 16 settings. Like David, we throughout the entire course of this podcast, we've been like learning all the things they use the phasers for. I mean, you can stun people, you can kill people, you can disintegrate people, you can warm up toast, you can warm up rocks,
you
to
can
keep,
melt
like,
metal, you can blow up people's heads.
Yes,
you can
blow
gently
people's heads up.
You can gently nudge a lamp.
Yes,
and now you can
that's
make
like nine a, things.
You can make a really perfect hole in the side
a
of
lava
mountain.
Tube. Yeah,
that was really neat. I wrote in my notes like, oh, new phaser setting. Like, very neat.
Yeah. You know what I did notice? I know this is a super covert mission and they're deep underground, but you know, there's sensors and stuff everywhere. They are not bothering to whisper at all. They're like, why don't you look over here? Okay, phasers at 60. I was like, guys, keep it down.
On the count of three. One, two, and three. Woo-hoo! High five, everybody.
Worf, over here. Guys, shut the fuck up. Like, we're doing a covert mission.
Well, they have
there's sensors everywhere. Come on, man. We're wearing black, so we blend in, and we're like party poppers.
Like, yeah, dude. I don't know, but apparently it didn't mean anything.
Worf's cell phone's going off,
right?
In the background.
And in their holodeck like practice, Cardassians were jumping out from every nook and cranny trying to get them.
I
and
know.
Here there's like not a Cardassian for miles.
Man,
so
apparently they're not even on Cardassia or in Cardassian space.
Yeah,
they're,
they didn't need to do all those squats.
They're on the moon, yeah.
I was just wasted cardio. So anyways, they get through the hole, they come around the corner, they're like just doing cool spy stuff, and then they find this little maintenance hatch, and they're like, okay, this is the spot.
Oh my gosh, but hold on. As they're crawling through the lava tube, basically Beverly's bringing up the rear, and it's like crushed by a rock fall. And I was like, oh my God, I did not remember that part. And I was like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And Worf jumps in and just starts throwing these styrofoam rocks out of the way. But in reality, it would be much harder. I remember doing some reading years ago about avalanches and how what makes an avalanche so deathly and so scary is that as soon as that avalanche sort of encapsulates you, it basically like freezes solid. So even if you're 6 inches under the surface of the snow, it's not fairy tale Disney snow. It's like ice that like is impenetrable, right? So people end up suffocating a lot. And I wondered if it was sort of the same thing with like a rock fall where it's like just the weight of the rocks alone, like Worf was able to get her out in like 10 seconds and luckily she's okay. But I was like, she could have been Beverly Jelly, like yeah, in a heartbeat.
She wasn't injured at all, but yeah. It looked like she would have been injured a lot. Like at least like, had a cute at least scar some on her sort eyebrow
of,
or something.
Yeah, at least some sort of like head trauma or something, like a broken rib. But yeah, that, I was like, God, that
it was all the and cardio.
Yeah.
Okay. So the squats and the cardio helped save her from a rock fall. That sounds perfectly.
Yeah. This tracks.
Perfectly logical. So she was fine. But yeah, it was a scary moment, right? And it was very exciting. Like this episode was very, like these scenes were very exciting where you're like, oh my gosh, Beverly's dead. Oh no, she's alive. Actually, she's totally fine. Okay. Why did we even do that? Why'd you put us through that? But they want to show that they're, even though we don't see Cardassians jumping from behind every rock, there are legitimate dangers. I mean, they already had me on that with the cliff thing. But here again, we're just like, this is legitimately dangerous. Even without someone shooting at you, it's dangerous.
Yeah, so yeah. There's so much tension here. Yeah. I was like, oh my God.
They come around the corner and they find this hatch and they open the hatch or they do all this cool stuff where they're like, oh, we're like blocking the sensors and we're going to release the magnets and all this stuff to open this hatch.
It's a magnetic door, which if TNG has taught us anything is that magnetic doors are like impenetrable. And also you can't blast them because Star Wars teaches us that if you try to blast something magnetic, it'll bounce all over and then it'll ricochet. Kill you by accident. Right. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. That's hey, listen, it happened in the garbage chute on the Death Star. Cool. Apparently. Okay.
So it's physics law. Got it.
Yeah, it's a thing, apparently. But Worf uses a super cool device because we've got the magnetic door and then there's three sensors, like three little cameras on each side. Mm-hmm. And so he sets up this little bitty tripod that kind of goes with all these lasers. And they're like, okay, what that's essentially going to do is it's going to imprint a false image in the sensors to make it look like the room is empty, even though we're in there. But it only is going to last a few minutes. So we got to like go.
It sets up a sensor echo. But if you've ever seen a heist movie, it's basically looping the footage, which is so cool. Like it's cool in a heist movie, it's cool in a TNG episode.
I wouldn't have thought of that. Like good thing I don't have a career in heisting or any of that, because I wouldn't think
it would be
that.
A very
like,
short career.
Yeah, I'd be like, and I'm caught.
It'd be more like an apprenticeship. It'd be like an internship. Anyways, so they put something else, another device on the actual door to demagnetize the door.
Sure.
So
to,
that it
to
can
make
unlock
it easier
it
open, to open.
To open it. To open it. So they put something on and I'm just loving this whole thing. I'm like, ooh, what's going to happen? So they click it and it like opens up. And before it does though, Picard gives them their instructions because they cannot scan inside the room. So they don't know if there's like 1,000 Cardassians in there. If there's no card, they don't know what they're going to walk into. So he's like, everybody get your phasers out. Set them on stun. He says,
level three,
let's not do 16 quite yet. And he says, aim low. So that's already saying like, don't kill anybody, right? Like aim for legs and whatnot. So he says, aim low and shoot in short controlled bursts, as opposed to just like, you know, just blasting everything when you come in, which I thought like, this is why people train for this. That has got to be so hard to do in this kind of a situation where you are expecting lots of bad guys right on the other side of the door for you to calmly, 100%. Collectively just take out kneecaps. It's like got to be so hard because you're just like freaking out and trying to save your own life and you're just going to be shooting everything. So anyways, those are his instructions. Go ahead.
Sorry. What they tell you to do in the military, and I wasn't in the military, but I've watched movies. You pray and you spray.
Yeah.
When you take a room like that, you just
shoot
shooting.
Everything.
Yeah. And that's, let me digress for a second. This is what I've never understood about Star Trek phasers. It is a constant beam. You can hold it on as long as you want.
And then just point it to
the point of the burst?
Target.
Harry just Potter around the room.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just laser pointer at that bad boy, right?
Yeah.
Well, also kudos for introducing a Harry Potter concept into Star Trek. Like my two biggest loves.
I mentioned dress robes earlier. So introducing Harry Potter at any point is acceptable on the show.
It's encouraged, doesn't it?
It's encouraged, yeah.
The tension is crazy because they finally like open the door and everything. They find the machine, but it's just like there's no one here. There's no lab. It's literally just there's the machine going. There's
nothing in that room but nothing. The machine. There's nothing on the walls. And there's nothing.
No, it's literally just a machine dropped off in an opening in a cavern. Like, there aren't even walls.
With
it's
a door a that has security all around the door to make you think something's inside.
They left, like, the big Bluetooth boombox just sitting there cranking. That's all it was.
They really did. And Picard looks at it and he goes, it's a trap. Get out. And boom, they get jumped by, like, 20 Cardassians.
Yeah, they all come out of the woodworks fighting. And here's one, because I wanted to see if the Worf effect was going to happen, right? Because it was like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't have brought Worf. But no, here's one of the rare times where Worf kicks butt and does not get beaten up. He kicks butt. He's tossing people left and right and throwing people all around. The door starts to close and Worf uses his body to hold the door open. And I was like, whoa, that was a very Data move right there. And so he's like, let's go. And so Beverly presses her body between the little crack between Worf and the opening of the door and squeezes her little self through. Picard, while on the other hand, is wrestling on the ground with a Cardassian, but that doesn't matter. Worf will let his back and his three spines be broken to make sure that Picard gets out safely. Yeah. So he's holding that door.
As he should. Yeah.
Until a Cardassian on the ground rolls over and shoots him in the shoulder with a phaser, which makes Worf fall, and then the door closes. There was, like, nothing short of getting shot that was going to keep Worf from not keeping that door open until Picard got through. So he falls through. He's hit. It looks like it really hurt. And Beverly's like, come on, let's go. And he's like, I can't. The captain's in there. We can't go. And Beverly's like, five more are headed this way right now. Let's go now. Because she's actually the senior officer at this point now.
Yes. Yeah. And now at this point, it's over. Like, Picard is surrounded. He drops his weapon. Cardassians have him all at phaser point and they're ready to take him out. Now, as a Cardassian, I would say this is a major fail moment right here because, yes, you got the captain, so that's cool.
But there was like 20 of you and three of them?
The other two, no, because there was like seven Cardassians in that room, like pointing their freaking phasers at Picard. How about four of you? Like, Picard's already disarmed. Like, you really just need one guy with a phaser, maybe two, you know, in case he decides to do some sort of hero maneuver. But, like, Beverly and Worf are, like, right beyond the door, which you can unlock at, like, the touch of a finger.
Like, just go after
them.
Just
go after them and get them, too. Like, why are you just letting them get away? I guess, I mean, as we see, who they really wanted was Picard. But if I were taking prisoners, I'd take as many as I can because then you have leverage to whatever. I was like, that wasn't, okay, whatever.
It wasn't very Cardassian of them. But we're happy that Bev and Worf got away.
I did ponder this because it's like, why did she leave so quickly? Why wouldn't she? I mean, obviously, that's the way it was written. But why would she leave so quickly? Well, if you stay behind, now they have, yes, more leverage if you get caught.
Yeah.
And so that becomes.
So that was a smart thing to do.
A bigger problem, right? And then them not chasing them, obviously, they had who they wanted. And they needed somebody to, you kind of always let somebody live so they can tell the story. Tale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. That's a good point.
That's very true. Now,
and they got away, which just blows my mind. How the F did they get away?
By the way, when they rappelled down very unsafely without the redundancies, Beverly looks up and she goes, please tell me you have some other sort of way to get up. And he's like, nope. So I'm like, so you guys have to just scale a 1500 foot high wall? Like, you said, what? Like, how are you supposed to get out of there? Well,
they said they could find another way, but it would take hours to go all around. So regardless of if they, but climbing also feels like they're just a really easy mark to get shot. But the point is, Cardassians didn't chase them. That's the point.
Yeah,
Cardassians
nobody chased
did not chase them. Yeah. So they had hours to pick their way back up slowly or to climb. They could have done anything they wanted to. Nobody cared about them.
Yeah, Worf, that's true.
Worf got out the hammock pitons and stuck those in and they took a nap. And
the portal edge, which is the tent you can sleep like against the edge of a cliff and you don't go anywhere. Yeah, they got those. They like took a 2-day like camping trip to get out of there.
Hard pass now, Riker on that gets, as well.
Oh my God, I love portal edges. The Riker gets an emission notification from Seltris 3. And of course, he knows nothing because he hasn't been briefed about any of it. And Jellico alerts Admiral Nechayev immediately. And I like that she's using good protocol. This is subspace communication, even though it's priority 2. I don't know why he wouldn't make it priority 1, but whatever, or like security 1. But in case it gets tapped, she says, have you heard from my friends? I'd very much like to see them again. And I was like, smart move, girl, because you don't want to be like, but what happened to Seltris 3 and Picard and Worf and Beverly? Are they trying to find that? You know, it's like,
did they find the secret base and destroy it? Did they? Yeah,
exactly.
Now, and they're both doing this whole secret code thing because Jellico's like, We just found out that problem we thought about earlier has ended. So it seems that our friends have solved the problem one way or another. And yeah. It's just like, have you heard from our friends? Not yet. Well, I hope so. Okay. Yeah. Talk later.
Now, the next thing we see is Picard handcuffed and bound and brought to a Cardassian torture chamber. Don't ask me how I know what a torture chamber is, but if you walk into that room handcuffed like that, it's a torture chamber. And I just wrote, oh my God, no, not Picard. And the Cardassian knows Picard's serial number, his family, his previous postings, everything.
Life, everything he's ever done, his mom's name, his dad's name, his brother's name, the first car he ever drove.
The nephew, Rene. Yeah. Like everything.
And
he's like, well, we had to know a lot about you because we had to design this elaborate ruse to ensnare you. And so Picard's like, what do you want from me? And he's like, in this room, you do not ask questions. I ask them and you will answer. And if I'm not satisfied with your answer, you die. And then it was the ultra bum, 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 like cliffhanger ending. And I was like,
he says, oh, you God. Die. And the episode ends. And you're like, wait, there was no follow-up statement. Hello? Hello? I have to wait till next week.
This is the sound that we ended the episode with. If this is not a cliffhanger, I don't know what is, because my heart was like palpitating and racing and everything just watching this. And I know how the episode ends next week, but still, it's just, David, what were your thoughts on this? Like, if I don't like your answers, you die.
Oh, wait, are you saying that to me or?
No.
I didn't know if that was.
If I don't like your answers, I will just accept them and move on. Yeah.
Again, what we learn about leadership in this episode, what we learn about, you know, conniving and getting, manipulating people to where you want them to be, which we watched Jellicoe try to manipulate the Cardassians, and all the whole time it looks like
he was being manipulated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's basically coming out on the short end of that stick.
It's kind of like this saying that I always, always say whenever I watch those heist movies, that there's no honor amongst thieves. Like, yes. There's always like these three people who do a robbery and we're going to split it three ways, but then one of them mysteriously dies. Now the other one's running for their life from the other one and they can't believe they would double cross them and keep the money and not share it. And it's like, really, you can't believe that? You don't believe that a thief stole from you?
Yeah.
Like, there's no honor amongst thieves. And that's kind of what's going on here. It's like, we're all manipulating and lying. There's no honor amongst spies. Like, of course they lied to you. Just like you lied to them.
Of course they did.
That's what we're doing here.
If you're not lying to your fellow crime person, you're not doing crime very well.
You're not criming at its optimum level. Right.
Everything about those sentences was magic. You're a crime person and you're not criming correctly. All right. What are some final thoughts about this week's episode? David, as our guest.
Well, before that, I said I had a question for all of you at the end of the episode.
Yes.
And to stay tuned. It turns out that question was actually for the end of next episode, but I'm going to ask it now because I have to close that loop for anyone listening who's like, what the F? So the question was, do you think that Captain Jellicoe was the right man for the job? I'm going to ask you that for this episode and where he is so far. And then I'm going to ask the same question at the end of next episode for where that ends up. So do you guys think that Jellicoe was the right man for the job at this moment in the story?
I will say that Jellicoe had the proper resume. He may not have been the right man.
Interesting.
Because he had the prior experience with the Cardassians, but for this particular situation, he may not have ultimately been the right person. But Nechayev had to make decisions. So she went with it based on the information that she had. And
hope for the best.
Hope for the best. Which is what life is.
Yeah.
Yeah. The situation brings to mind the saying, right for it, you know, right place, right time. And he just happened to be an expert on paper, an expert in Cardassians, which, by the way he handled the negotiations with the Cardassians was so just ridiculous and stupid. I was like, God, I feel like Keiko could have done a better job. And she's a civilian. Come on. I mean, not a dig on Keiko. She's a fabulous person. I love her. But like, she's a botanist who's a civilian. She just married a guy in Starfleet. You know what I mean? Like, she could have done a better job. And she was the least qualified aboard the ship. You know, or Alexander could have done a better job. So, but like on paper, he has that, you know, expert with dealing with Cardassians. And I think what that really means is he's just negotiated with them a bunch, probably poorly. But also, I think you're right. Like, Nechayev is like, we have this information. We need to act on it now. So he was in the right place at the right time to take command of the ship so that Picard could go running around in some caverns and stuff. But so far, I don't hate the job that he's doing. He's just reminding everybody that this is a military vessel and we're on an urgent military mission. There isn't time to be listening to Ota Spot and watching a string quartet perform and like making friends. I think if Jellicoe was assigned to the Enterprise for like a long-term mission that didn't have that same urgency, he probably would have taken the time to get to know the team. Cause he even admitted like, yeah, that would actually be really helpful, but there's just no time to do that. So I guess that's my thought on him, but I probably will have some very different thoughts if you ask me the same question next week.
Yeah, that's my plan. I wrote it down. So I'll ask you the same question next week. Okay. So now to your first thing about final thoughts, David, as our guest, what were your final thoughts about part one?
Great cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Just it led you right up with, you know, it's a true nail biter. You're trying to figure out what's going on and it's done. Wait.
I need more. I would say this is right up there with the Locutus of Borg episode. This with as far as being a really great cliffhanger where you're like, wait, what? I think all the other cliffhangers we've had have been like, oh, that's interesting. Guess we'll see what happens next time. But that Locutus of Borg one when Riker's like, fire, and you're like, oh my gosh, he's gonna kill the captain. And this one, when it's like, you die. This has been the episode of the cliffhangers, right? Because the intro before the commercial break was like, I'm here to relieve you of duty. And you're like, what? And then it ends with, you die. And the show just stops. It's very dramatic. So yeah, my final thoughts was that this episode was really intense. And it definitely leaves a bad taste in the mouth. And I almost want to apologize for anyone listening because this quote unquote fun keeps going next week. Like, we're going to keep doing this for a while. It's a great story, though.
It's the word fun. We're just changing the definition of the word. I agree with you. For my final thoughts, I wrote, I think this is a really great episode. It's one that I normally skip because of the heaviness of it. But it's a great episode. It is so strong in every aspect. The only weak moment that I wish they would have got rid of is that stupid bar scene.
Yeah.
But it's lasted 2 minutes, so who cares? Like, the story perfectly conveys the urgency of the mission. And I tell you, I will be watching next week's episode, like, through the slits in my fingers, because it's just so hard to watch. And I'm really glad we're doing this podcast, because if we weren't, I would just skip this episode and never watch it again. I'm actually really glad I got to see it because it is amazing. And I also love to see Deanna like in a regulation uniform. She's wearing like the blue regulation uniform and she looks
so good.
I mean, she always looks amazing.
She always looks great. It's cool to see her in the blue. You're like, oh yeah, she is part of the medical department. Like, that's what my thought was when I saw her. I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah. Because like counseling is like,
it's healthcare. Medical, it's but mental. She's healthcare. Always wearing purple. You just don't even think about
it. Or green or gray. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I will say Counselor Troy and Marina Sirtis in general as an actress in the costumes they put her in really does beautifully prove the point that you don't have to show like everything to still look really sexy. You know what I mean? Like, yes, she usually wears low cut stuff. She's got beautiful cleavage. I get that. I get why, like, you know, people of all ages were all like jazzed about it back in the day. But yes, she's more covered up, but she still looks completely rockin'. She does. She just looks super classy, super sexy, super cool, but also like smart, confident, capable, which I think is like even sexier than just like bimbo cheerleader. But yeah, I love to see it. And moving forward, I think she stays in the regulation uniform. So if Jellicoe did nothing else, he gave us Counselor Troy in the regulation uniform, which she looks amazing in.
I will say she's probably never had more clothes on than when she was Durango.
That's because
she has layers.
Looks great.
She did look great. If I ever did a Star Trek cosplay, it would probably be as Durango, because that outfit was so banging. I was like, holy crap, this is Deadwood all over again. It's amazing. Anyway, all right, we'll be... Fun continues next week with season 6, episode 11, Chain of Command Part 2. Thank you guys so, so much for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for geeking out with us. Be sure to join the crew at thetngpodcast.com to be the first to know when we do our live shows or host events exclusively for our members. We'll see you next time.